Hey, Trey here. Two things. First, I'm not sure if you know it, but Us and Them was honored with four Associated Press Broadcasters Awards, including one for excellence in public service through journalism. Second, it's the time for the Spring Pledge Drive at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And if you value the work that our Us and Them team does in telling the stories about the things that divide Americans, would you consider making a pledge of support to West Virginia Public Broadcasting? You can call or text to 1-800-RADIO-87, or you can go online to WV Public and find the little red button at the upper right-hand corner. And when you pledge, let them know where you live and that you're a listener of Us and Them. Doing this would be a big help for our show and the other great programming at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And thank you so much. This episode contains graphic descriptions of gun violence and shootings. It may not be for all listeners. Hey, it's Trey Kay, and from West Virginia Public Broadcasting and PRX, you're listening to Us and Them, the show that tells the stories about the things that divide Americans. People say the United States is a gun-loving country. We're also a disconnected country. And our divides become even more apparent after a mass shooting.
Good evening to you. Buffalo is in mourning tonight.
Like the recent incident in Buffalo, New York. An 18-year-old white man faces murder charges for killing 10 African Americans in a grocery store.
To see that sense of security shattered.
The FBI is investigating it as a racially motivated hate crime.
Engaged in an act of terrorism.
This was pure evil. It was straight up racially motivated hate crime.
The gunman used an illegally modified AR-15 to make it more lethal. It's a rifle that gun rights supporters say is protected under the Second Amendment. But is it? In this episode, we'll explore the foundations of the Second Amendment and the cultural and historical myths that contribute to our very American divide over guns. Many of the stories we tell about freedom and individualism have guns at their core. From the American Revolution to the Civil War, to fantasies about the Wild West and the Black Panthers, guns are integral to American identity. They are how we fight some of our struggles and achieve victories. Gun ownership is at record levels across the country. Today, 40% of adults say they have at least one firearm in their home. The most common reason for a gun? Self-protection. As gun ownership increases, state laws are allowing more people to carry more guns. We're also seeing a historic rise in gun violence. Guns killed 45,000 people in 2020. There's been a slight drop in mass shootings in the past 2 years, but the recent killing of 10 African Americans in Buffalo reminds us gun violence can show up anywhere. Research shows urban Democrats and African Americans tend to favor more restrictive gun policies. White Republican men own the most guns in the country and favor fewer restrictions on them.
But I appreciate it.
2911.
We begin our story at the Good Family Pharmacy in the tiny town of Pinch, West Virginia. It's just about 13 miles from the state capitol building in Charleston. You can get prescriptions filled here. They also sell toiletries, vitamins, cosmetics. And as pharmacist Don Radcliffe tells me, the Good Family Pharmacy offers customers something a little extra.
We also have a gun store here in the pharmacy.
Oh, like I could purchase a weapon here in this pharmacy?
Yeah, I mean, right here. There's a little door right over there. If you open up that door, you'll see three gun safes full of guns.
Radcliffe unlocks the door, and we're in what looks like a small stockroom. The safes, three huge black metal cabinets, fill the space. A stuffed bobcat seems to keep guard. Guns are big around Pinch, a rural town of 3,000. Radcliffe tells me guns keep the town free from big city crime problems.
We are insulated from that here, and I think one of the reasons that we are insulated is because you never know who's going to be carrying a gun here.
You may have guessed it by now. This pharmacist, sporting a stern crew cut and a graying goatee, carries a firearm.
Absolutely. Have for 30 years. When I get up in the morning and put my clothes on, I put my gun on. It's just part of my attire.
How come?
It's my right. I don't need to have a reason to carry one. It's the founding fathers gave us that right.
Like many West Virginians, including me, Radcliffe's sense of entitlement with guns was nurtured early in life. My dad used to frequently take my brother and I out shooting. Radcliffe says that sounds familiar.
I've been shooting a gun since I was 5 years old. I have my own range on my own property.
He'll often go through 100 rounds of ammunition during target practice.
We like our guns. I mean, we like to hunt. I've got two sons. They were, you know, both of them were 3 years old when they saw their first bear up a tree. It's in our blood. February 18th, 2015.
You remember that day?
I'll always remember that day.
7 years ago, big city crime did come to Pinch. Radcliffe was on duty at the pharmacy.
A customer came into the pharmacy with a hoodie and a bandana over his face. Couldn't tell, you know, who it was. Just thought he was trying to keep warm. I actually made a joke and said, better watch this fella. He might be here to rob us. And, you know, he didn't respond, which kind of made me a little apprehensive, because had it been one of our normal customers, they'd have joked around right back with me. I was on edge, I guess would be the right word. And then when I walked over and asked him if he was dropping off or picking up, and he pulled a gun out of his pocket, and I pulled mine and shot first.
Radcliffe's first bullet hit Terry Gillenwater, a 25-year-old white man, square in the chest.
He fell away, still had his gun pointed at me. My second shot actually hit the end of his pistol and racked a slide and took it out of battery to where his gun couldn't fire, which I didn't know at the time. My third shot hit him through the side, and that was actually the shot that killed him.
Tonight at 6, an attempted robbery that took a tragic turn has a lot of people talking today.
And tonight we hear from the pharmacist who defended himself.
The shooting brought a spotlight and some celebrity to Radcliffe. Details about the man he killed got brief mention, but surveillance video of the shooting is still available online. A tribute to what many call a heroic act.
It's not something I ever planned to do, not something I ever wanted to do. But again, like I say, you know, his state being strung out, if you will, it's hard to tell what would have happened.
Police investigators interviewed Radcliffe, but he was not charged with any crime. He got his gun back the next morning. Don Radcliffe and his supporters say that the shooting was in self-defense. It's a scenario we're all familiar with. Popular culture has made a white man with a gun into an image we're all used to. Heroes with guns protect their workplaces, stand their ground. They're the good guys, right?
What is defined as a good guy? I've never seen good guy in any code.
Danielle Walker is a liberal Democratic member of the West Virginia House of Delegates. She is the only African-American woman in the West Virginia State Legislature.
These same good guys that have a domestic go back and kill their spouse and children. So what is defined as a good guy?
One common image of a good guy is defined by demographic research. Most often, gun owners in America are white, rural, southern men. But gun ownership is growing in other demographic groups. Women now make up 42% of the country's 80 million plus gun owners. The pandemic saw a historic shopping spree for guns. In the past 2 years, nearly 8 million Americans became new gun owners. Of those, half are women, 20% are Hispanic, and 20% are African American. Delegate Walker reluctantly bought a firearm after receiving death threats.
I didn't want a handgun because it was just another stressor in my life that I didn't need.
She says the threat started in 2020 when she was invited to attend a Black Lives Matter rally in Kingwood, West Virginia. It's a community that borders her district. A Black Kingwood resident organized the rally just a few months after a Minneapolis police officer murdered George Floyd. As the word got out about the march, people from around the area posted on Facebook that they would show up to protect the town. It was a tense day, filled with hateful talk, raging anger, and a lot of guns. We did an episode about that event for Us and Them. White counter-protesters showed up on motorcycles and trucks. They had Confederate, American, and Donald Trump flags flying, and an arsenal of weapons.
Black lives! Black lives!
Go on there, your place! Get your hood back up here!
Use the N-word!
Walker says since that day, the threats have continued online.
That threat was, we need to get rid of her by any means necessary. These folks would take pictures even if I went to the gas station and pumped gas. So they started taking pictures of my vehicle with my license plate. So no matter where I was traveling, they would post it on social media. And what was most hurtful was there was a county bus driver that posted that. Someone who knew that my youngest son rode special needs transportation in the school system. That's when it realized that this is not people who don't know me. These are people who I know and I respect.
Some people, like pharmacist Don Radcliffe, carry a gun as a part of their attire. But Danielle Walker says carrying a handgun everywhere she goes is a burden soaked in double standards.
You have to be aware and beware, if that makes sense. You have to be aware of who and whom you are. And this beautiful brown skin is a weapon within its own. It's not something I checked. It's not a multiple choice. It's not something my parents didn't want, but I am blessed to be born in this beautiful brown skin. And for some folks, that is a weapon within its own. So I have to be aware of that. And think about, how is that first responder going to interact with me once I say, yes, I do have a firearm? Is that person going to immediately pull out a gun on me? Is that person going to allow me to get my gun out of my case? Or if I have it concealed in my purse, what is that going to look like? Doing stops, I had already urinated on myself just with the friction of being engaged because of such fear of what you hear around the world. And so what was going to happen now with me exercising my Second Amendment right, that may cause someone to put an extra marking on me. And it's an unknown. It's an unknown and a stress that I have to live with all the days of my life. And it's not fair.
Walker belongs to a local gun safety group and supports laws that require better training and information about guns.
Being a Black woman with a handgun, I still have to watch the way in which I carry myself and how I speak around guns and not being insensitive because gun violence is still prevalent in many communities of color and all communities throughout America and the world. We're seeing that all over. But what I will not be is apologetic of exercising my Second Amendment right, whether that is with a handgun, a rifle, or a shotgun. It is my choice that I feel that I don't want or need an automatic weapon, but that is my choice. What is the need of those things? I haven't seen it.
Government statistics show that guns kill 100 Americans every day. Hundreds more are wounded. In 2020, America saw the highest number of gun deaths ever in one year, 45,000 people. That year, the majority of gun deaths were suicides. Homicides made up the next highest number. It's a 43% increase over the previous decade. According to the Annals of Internal Medicine, when there's a gun in a home, particularly a handgun, suicide risk increases threefold. More white men commit suicide than any other group, but that's changing. Brady United Against Gun Safety is a national gun control advocacy group. It reports that attempted firearm suicides among African-American teens spiked more than 70% between 1991 and 2017. Researchers attribute the increase to exposure to racism, trauma, and access to guns. African Americans are also more likely to be the victims of gun homicide. In the United States, Black Americans are 10 times more likely to die from gun violence than white Americans. The number goes up for Black children and teens, who are 14 times more likely than white children to die from a gunshot. The small state of West Virginia reveals similar disparities. Data show Black West Virginians are victims of gun homicide at 5 times the rate of white West Virginians. Across the state each year, an average of nearly 1 person a day is killed by guns.
I think for West Virginia, we may be the epicenter for the gun violence in a community, heavily hitting young people, teenagers and young adults.
Reverend Matthew Watts has been pastor at Grace Bible Church on Charleston's west side for more than 3 decades. He also lives in the community and tries to bring attention to its struggles.
Thought I was a slave plantation community, a segregated community, a heavily populated, low-income and African-American community. It's really has been disinvested in and ignored for many, many years. So it's really declined. So we have a very high crime rate, high drug trafficking, violent crime for a small place like this. You wouldn't think it's as high as it is.
Watts says teens and young men drawn to the drug trade have easy access to illegal guns.
There's absolutely a lot of guns in this community. There are juveniles that are being arrested with possession of firearms. There are juveniles that are committing gun crimes. So we all should be alarmed when juveniles have firearms because they don't have the maturity, they're somewhat volatile. They cannot legally own the gun, so it's illegal. And so I think it's really a very toxic cocktail. Their conflict resolution skills are not that good. And so unlike back in the day, you know, when I was a young person, you know, we're just going to fight, you know, and then whoever wins, wins. We're going to shake hands and go play basketball, right? These kids now, they don't physically fight that much, particularly the boys. And so these children have learned, I think, through exposure, that resolving a conflict with a firearm is a legitimate way to resolve it. And it's been normalized.
And Reverend Watts has preached at many funerals for young victims of gun violence.
I think it is by far the most difficult thing that I have to do, because it is so complicated. So when someone in this community is murdered, and very often someone from the community murders someone from the community, well, in the funeral, you got people on both sides. You got people that are there, they knew the victim. You got people there, they knew the perpetrator, they knew both. I mean, it's just a very difficult thing. It's devastating to the families. Beyond belief. The grief is so heavy, right? it is just so profound and just so pronounced that you can feel the weight of it, right, in the community, in the whole community. And what I'm telling you, we've been traumatized over by so much violence. And I was telling people that I hadn't been honest with myself. It's affected me. And I kept trying to say that it wasn't affecting me, feeling trapped in a system that you can't change no matter how hard you try, no matter how hard you work. You know, you just can't.
What's happening on Charleston's West Side plays out in communities all over the country. An intractable cycle of poverty and violence fueled by guns. And it's getting even more dangerous as gun trafficking and internet gun kits make access easier than ever before. West Virginia reports more than half, up to 70% of state residents, own at least one gun. It's a pretty lonely and frustrating place for a gun safety advocate.
It's not easy. My friends think I'm crazy.
Jim McJunkin is a retired pediatrician in Charleston. He's now an unpaid legislative representative for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense. That's a program launched 10 years ago after Sandy Hook, the mass shooting of school children in Newtown, Connecticut. The group is an arm of Everytown, a national organization devoted to stopping gun violence. When the legislature is in session, McJunkin spends his days at the state capitol visiting lawmakers and advocating for gun safety in committee hearings. But in West Virginia, as in most red states, the gun rights lobby has more seats at the table.
It does seem like they're winning. Look like at the history of what's happened here in this state over the past 8 years or so. And I also think that somehow the public is not... I know a lot of people could see a middle ground, but they feel futile about finding it, saying that there could be some reasonable things that don't take away a person's Second Amendment rights, and we could do them. I have six grandchildren. None of them live here in West Virginia. I hope they'll come back someday. But there are people who have children and grandchildren here in West Virginia, and I don't see them, in my mind, speaking up the way I think they could.
During the 2022 legislative session, there were just two bills focused on gun safety. They would have provided tax credits for firearms training, gun safes, and devices like gun locks. Neither of those bills even got a hearing. On the other hand, there were a couple of dozen gun rights bills. Perhaps the most controversial was a bill allowing teachers to carry guns in schools. The bill did not pass, despite a Republican majority, but local gun rights advocates say they'll bring it back next legislative session. McJunkin tries to stay hopeful, but as a lifelong West Virginian, where guns are ubiquitous, he's a realist. And he knows well where lawmakers are coming from.
I do understand the technical beauty of a gun and how people are into that. If you have people in your family who are just really into cars, as I do, like one of my brothers, there's a beauty in that machinery. And I think a lot of that goes into what people feel about guns, too. So I don't refute that or disrespect that. I get that part of it. I just think there are ways, and I think even technology could provide us ways to be safer without impinging on people's rights. But again, people haven't had the experience that I have of seeing a family's life ruined by their perfectly normal child being rendered quadriplegic and the 4 years of suffering after that.
That case, early in his career in the 1990s, changed Dr. Jim McJunkin's perspective on guns forever.
I was called to the intensive care unit to see a boy who had been shot. The bullet had severed his spinal cord in his neck. And so this child was rendered quadriplegic, in other words, unable to move his arms or its legs, and unable to breathe. He was intubated, placed on a ventilator, and he could never come off that ventilator. He then had to have a tracheostomy and go home on a home ventilator. He had been shot by his brother unintentionally. The kids were playing, and the gun discharged and caused this horrific injury. After 4 years' time with just many recurrent pneumonias, he succumbed and died. So that was the thing that, to me, here was something completely preventable and affected just not this family, I'm sure this entire community had to be shocked, unable to cope with what really happened.
McJunkin says children as young as 2 or 3 can be the victims of accidental, self-inflicted gunshot wounds when they play with unsecured guns. In 2020, gun violence became the number one cause of death nationally for children under 19. In West Virginia, guns are the second leading cause of death for children and teens. McJunkin looks at those statistics and sees a public health crisis.
It's hard to see it any other way.
Yet, policies McJunkin and other gun safety advocates put forward in West Virginia are mostly ignored. He says it's frustrating to watch the state's gun laws loosen year after year. The number one measure McJunkin and other gun safety advocates are calling for focuses on gun training and safe gun storage. They want laws to require that unloaded guns are stored separately from ammunition. They also want background checks before gun purchases.
It's been shown that in states that have had good background checks in place for more than 5 years, that there's 35% fewer firearm deaths in children and teens. With this kind of data to say that background checks can save lives, the lack of anything getting done at the federal level, that concerns me. Then, you know, here in our state, we can't get enough traction to help people to be incentivized to just buy safety equipment or take a safety training course. But this would be maybe a bridge too far, but we should talk about the fact that child access prevention laws have been very effective, maybe could reduce these accidental deaths in children and suicides by a third to a half, because just carefully securing the gun takes away the means of this person who may impulsively take their life, especially in teens.
McJunkin and gun safety advocates nationwide support what are called extreme risk laws, also known as red flag laws. These laws allow family members to petition the court to remove a gun from a family member who may harm themselves or others.
This sounds very sort of drastic, but it is in place in some states and has been effective in reducing firearm deaths. And so these are things that bear discussion, bear debate, and, you know, maybe someday even in a state like ours. I respect our gun culture here, and I love this state, and that's why I speak up, basically.
So far this year, gun violence has killed nearly 16,000 people, and mass shootings are picking up. The racially motivated killing of 10 African Americans in Buffalo is just the latest example. Despite these grim statistics, or maybe because of them, more Americans are more heavily armed than ever before, and more people say their gun is for protection. There are close to 400 million legal guns in civilian hands. As we mentioned earlier, firearms purchases spiked dramatically during the pandemic. That added about 15 million more guns into the collective arsenal. For years, the powerful gun rights movement, led by the National Rifle Association, or NRA, has leaned heavily on the Second Amendment to support gun ownership. Now, gun owners are pushing for more guns in more places. Coming up, we'll unpack the complexities of the Second Amendment and just what our constitutional rights involve. And we'll take a closer look at the cultural and historical forces behind America's obsession with guns. That's after a break. You're listening to Us and Them. This program is supported in part by the West Virginia Humanities Council, the Greater Kanawha Valley Foundation, the CRC Foundation, and the Daywood Foundation.
Music lifts us up and brings us together, even when we can't get together in person. Mountain Stage brings you live performances on the air, online, and in our podcast. They remind you how it feels to be in a live audience listening to live music. This is Larry Gross, host of Mountain Stage. Find a link to our stations and our podcast online at mountainstage.org.
It's Trey, and you're listening to Us and Them from PRX and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Every gun owner we interviewed for this story, regardless of their politics, invoked the Second Amendment as the source of their right to bear arms. It reminds me how entwined guns are with American identity and our ideas about freedom.
For many in the United States, firearms are part of what made the U.S. what it is today in a positive sense.
Historian Jennifer Tucker specializes in the history of industrialization, science, and law.
For others, firearms are associated with terrible things that happen to them and their family. And for that reason, the gun issue is it's a source of pain. It's also a source of pleasure. It's a source of entertainment and community, and it's a source of grief. If we're not even looking at the same phenomena, it's very hard to agree on any practical solutions.
Tucker recently launched the Center for the Study of Guns and Society at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut.
Connecticut's an interesting place to be studying the issue of guns and society because it's a microcosm of the issues in the country as a whole. So the Connecticut River Valley was an early incubator for the nation's gun industry. It's where companies like Colt, Smith, and Wesson, and Winchester made their start. At the same time, it's also part of an American story of shootings, you know, Sandy Hook, but also New Haven Botanical Garden of Healing, which opened in 2020 in West Rock, is a memorial to the individual deaths that have resulted from gun violence dating back to 1976. And Newtown, in addition to being the site of Sandy Hook, is also the site of the headquarters of the National Shooting Sports Federation. And so within Connecticut, there are a variety of different ways that people relate to guns, just like they do in the country.
Tucker says popular culture defines most people's understanding of American gun history.
The Lone Ranger!
Kyle Silver! Away!
For example, the Wild West with its movies, TV shows, and novels. But Tucker says museums and theme parks that make up our cultural touch points are not always based in reality.
There was a lot of gun violence and there was circulation of guns. And yet in 19th century frontier towns, there was also regulation of guns. So part of what impelled me as a historian, trying to understand how gun violence is remembered, was just noticing that there are these big gaps between what people think happened in the past and what really did happen.
Tucker says similar gaps, myths really, inform popular understanding of the Second Amendment.
And it's important to understand that these myths are more than just a Hollywood-influenced story. They have immense power in shaping society and people's beliefs about our country's legacy around guns. They even influence gun laws. One of the myths that I would point to is that the Second Amendment, as it was written by the founders, protected a right for individuals to carry firearms for their personal self-defense whenever and wherever they wanted. In fact, neither English nor American history supports a broad Second Amendment right to carry firearms or other dangerous weapons in public based on a generic interest in self-defense.
Here's what the Second Amendment actually says. It's short. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed. Interpreting this single sentence is complicated. In fact, the meaning we give these words is deeply consequential to how we understand American gun culture and how we interpret our rights. For years, the Second Amendment has been at the heart of the push for less regulation of firearms. A U.S. Supreme Court case in 2008 was the first time a legal ruling supported a person's right to keep a weapon for personal use. Conservative Justice Antonin Scalia wrote the decision in the case, District of Columbia versus Heller. Historian Jennifer Tucker says Scalia's decision shows how present-day perspectives on gun rights are presented as something steeped in history, when in reality, the attitudes are very modern.
Justice Scalia claimed that there was a long tradition of the English states granting freedom to possess weapons dating back to the English Bill of Rights. However, most scholars of English and American history vigorously dispute the accuracy of that claim. In fact, there were over 700 years of transatlantic weapons regulations. There was never any absolute right to carry guns. So that's an example of where the turn to originalism, the turn to look at what the founders thought was the nature of English common law, ended up influencing gun policy today. Because the 2008 decision was the first time that the court had interpreted the Second Amendment that way. It was a radical reinterpretation of the Second Amendment.
The watershed Heller decision was a huge win for gun rights and the National Rifle Association.
It's fair to say that without the work of the National Rifle Association, we would not have the Heller decision.
Daryl Miller is a Duke University law professor and co-founder of the Duke Center for Firearms Law.
The National Rifle Association's influence is huge. They obviously are very well financed. Even though Wayne LaPierre obviously has been living a very wealthy and rich lifestyle as the head of this nonprofit, they still have money to spare on a host of other kinds of issues. And so their influence has been profound. But to be fair, any kind of advocacy organization, including the NRA, could not operate unless there was a very impassioned, very motivated constituency that they represent. And so to just say it's the NRA is to forget that the NRA actually does represent millions of people that have very broad views about what gun policy should be and what gun rights are.
As influential as the Supreme Court's Heller decision has been, Miller says Justice Scalia's ruling left many unanswered questions. Though it's been law for more than a decade, what it says, how it says it, and what's left out are still hotly debated and litigated.
Well, first he says that the Second Amendment is not absolute.
Miller is referring to Justice Scalia here.
And he says nothing in this opinion should cast doubt on longstanding regulations. And then he gives a list of longstanding regulations, including firearms in sensitive places such as government buildings and schools, or firearms being prohibited from the hands of people that are adjudicated mentally ill or felons, or regulations on the commercial sale of arms. So this carve out from what would otherwise have seemed a rather absolutist opinion has been the stuff of post-Heller litigation about, well, what do you mean by sensitive places? Do you mean just violent felons, or do you mean any felony? When you say longstanding, how longstanding does it have to be? Can it be 50 years? Does it have to be 100 years? Does it have to be going back to the founding of the nation in the 18th century? Could it be during Reconstruction, which would be in the middle of the 19th century? This is all stuff for litigation, some of which might be resolved or at least addressed in this pending case before the Supreme Court right now called New York State Rifle and Pistol Association Incorporated versus Bruin. But my suspicion is there will be many unanswered questions after even Bruin, and that we'll see many, many decades of more litigation to try to figure out what exactly are the bounds of the Second Amendment.
As we were producing this story, a decision was imminent in the case Miller just mentioned, the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin. The defendant is Kevin P. Bruin, in his capacity as superintendent of the New York State Police. The case challenges the constitutionality of a state gun permitting regulation. At issue, whether New York's concealed carry law requires that people show why they need to carry a weapon off their property. The outcome of this case could have widespread national consequences for the gun safety movement. By the way, New York is a bit of a holdout on this policy. Today, almost half the states in the country, mostly red states, no longer require a license when someone carries a concealed gun outside their home. West Virginia was an early adopter of this practice called permitless carry. The state has not required carry permits since 2016. Also gone, a requirement for gun training. The state allows almost anyone to carry a gun anywhere with no requirements focused on safe and secure handling and storage of weapons. Daryl Miller says a broad decision in the Bruin case would make permitless carry the law of the land.
A really broad opinion would just strike down all licensing altogether and simply say the Constitution, the Second Amendment, does not permit a government to issue licenses at all. That, as the gun rights people say, the only license that you need was ratified in 1791, and therefore no permitting for concealed carry is permitted under the Constitution, and that the only qualification for carrying a gun is that you have a right to possess it in the first place. That is, you're not a felon, you've not been adjudicated mentally ill, you're not a minor child, etc.
If permitless carry becomes a constitutional right, Miller says it's not clear what kind of weapons people will claim as their Second Amendment right to bear arms.
We know from Heller that the word arms applies to things like pistols or handguns. Do they apply to large capacity magazines? Do they apply to silencers? Do they apply to AR-15s? Do they apply to things like homemade guns, sometimes called ghost guns? Does it apply to things like, I've got a drone and I want to put a 9mm firearm, I want to attach it to my drone and patrol my neighborhood with the drone? Does it apply to that? All these questions are on the table. All these questions are going to have to be answered.
As Miller noted, homemade ghost guns are a new area of contention. The guns have no serial numbers and are therefore untraceable. A consumer can buy a gun kit online, get it delivered to their home, build a steel or plastic gun in about 30 minutes. Another option is to build a gun directly from a 3D printer. Ghost guns are a favorite of gun and drug traffickers, and they're showing up in the recent spike in violent crime. Statistics from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, the ATF, show 20,000 suspected ghost guns were recovered from crime scenes nationwide last year. Only the District of Columbia and a handful of states currently have laws regulating or banning ghost guns. But the White House recently announced new rules to crack down on the sale of gun kits. When the Founding Fathers wrote and ratified the Second Amendment in 1791, the firearms of the day were flintlock muskets. Wesleyan University professor Jennifer Tucker says our laws need to change just as our weapons have.
And arms technology is still evolving. Today, there are popular devices that can turn a gun into a machine with about the same lethality as a machine gun. Not enough people are talking about this on either side of the gun debate. If we want to reduce the amount of gun violence in society, why are we not talking about the evolution of the lethality of firearms? Why aren't we having that conversation? The question of gun violence, it's not only a matter of trying to assess risk, of trying to limit the number of guns. It's also a question of history, of culture, of how groups relate to each other. And how people remember the history matters, because history is becoming important more than ever, not only in terms of interpreting the law because of the turn to originalism. It's tremendously important because whether or not the popular history of the Wild West is factually accurate, the idea that there were no laws at all and people could walk around carrying guns for any old reason, whether or not that's true, if people believe that, that becomes a kind of a version of history that some in the U.S. want to enshrine. If we think that the past is just baked in and we're just kind of recovering it, then it makes it harder to fashion policies that make sense for us today.
Research shows nearly half of Americans believe gun violence is a problem. But the Pew Research Center reveals a deepening divide along partisan lines. 73% of Democrats consider gun violence to be a very big problem, but only 18% of Republicans say the same. On the question of expanded concealed carry, 72% of Republicans like the idea, while only 20% of Democrats do. Those ideological gaps are getting wider, and gun supporters want to see weapons allowed in more places. Duke University law professor Daryl Miller says the move to weaken restrictions on gun ownership and allow guns in more places is based on three arguments.
One would be that this is just overall good for everybody, that as an empirical matter, as a criminological matter, the more guns that you have in a society, the less crime you're going to have. And so having more guns is just good for everybody. When pressed on that particular point, gun rights advocates, if they feel that the empirics are not on their side, will often then flip to a second argument, which is, well, it doesn't matter whether it's good for anybody and everybody. It just matters that it's a right. It's good for me. So it doesn't matter what the empirics are. It doesn't matter if it makes people more safe or less safe. It's just a right. And so I have a kind of interest in my own personal autonomy, irrespective of the effect that it'll have on either me or others. And the third argument that you often hear is, well, what if the United States military became despotic? I need to have these guns because I need to successfully be able to defend myself against a tyrannical government. My personal view is, I'm not sure how much legal content that kind of argument has, but it has a very, very powerful political impact in the anti-tyranny rationale for possessing guns.
There are roughly 400 million guns in circulation in America. Our divisions fuel even more gun purchases. And I can't help but wonder what happens when our collective arsenal intersects with our widespread distrust of our institutions, our government, and each other.
It gets even more concerning when we think about the way in which firearms are being deployed and political violence is being deployed in things like the conspiracy to kidnap and perhaps murder the governor of Michigan or the January 6th insurrection.
Miller says when the presence of firearms becomes a normalized way to express political convictions rather than peaceful demonstrations, it's a problem.
Guns are a kind of emblem of security and autonomy. And they have become more and more a kind of symbol of a person's identity. And when you start talking about people and their relationships with guns, you're really talking about not the thing, you're talking about their sense of themselves. We can't have a healthy democracy if only the persons that are coming with the guns have the most say. That seems an incredibly dangerous point to be at, and I really fear that the normalization of political violence through this tool of firearms is going to undermine all the other kind of commitments we have as a democratic republic.
Our state and federal courts will continue to hear cases that contest the meaning of the Second Amendment. At the same time, our country's appetite for weapons grows. As I talked with Professor Daryl Miller from Duke, I thought about my friends and family who own and use guns for hunting and target practice. Those are some of the events and traditions we've shared over generations. For me, the right to bear arms is mainly about recreational shooting, not about defending my life or liberty. When weapons and politics mix, the result can be a contentious legal case or an armed attack on the U.S. Capitol. As a nation, we have different ideas about the Second Amendment. We just can't seem to agree on what it means. You've been listening to Us and Them. Our team for this episode is me, Trey Kay. Marisa Helms wrote, scored, and mixed this show. Kate Smith is our editor. Special thanks to Michael Callahan and Truett Harris. Michael Lipton and Tristan Lozow wrote and performed the Us and Them show music. Mark Lerner designed our logo. The marvelous people at PRX and West Virginia Public Broadcasting make Us and Them possible. So do grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the West Virginia Humanities Council, the Greater Kanawha Valley Foundation, the CRC Foundation, and the Daywood Foundation. Us and Them was originally developed with assistance from the mentorship program at AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio. We'll see you next time on Us and Them.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.